You're not going to want to miss this next episode of the AI Show, where Ewan takes us to the next level of data preparation and even shows us a little GUI that is super slick. Make sure you tune in. Hello and welcome to this episode of the AI Show, the third and final installment of the series where, like, Ewan flashed up this GUI all out of nowhere and I didn't have enough time to ask. He just moved on to this other thing. Why don't you fill us in? But we've been talking about data preparation. Why don't you summarize the last two things we've talked about and then get into this cool thing.
Okay, so we started off and we talked about data preparation just as a general problem in data science. And what makes it unique in the data science and AI space from perhaps the BI space or some other places? Then we talked about specific approaches to that and showed how it was unique. Well, some of it's a little time consuming, a little experimental.
Yes.
And so then we showed some new stuff that we brought out at Ignite in preview to allow you to simplify your job, you know, be more accurate, move a little faster on a few things, make some things a lot simpler, like the ability to write single code base that runs cross-platform, deal with files which are bigger than memory, mm-hmm. a whole bunch of stuff like that. And I did taunt you right at the very
yes.
end. I was doing my super exciting API demos, and you were falling asleep on me, so I just slipped in a quick GUI there because I know you're a GUI sort of guy.
You flashed the UI at me, man.
Okay.
It was pretty good.
So let's go show even more goodness in the GUI.
Let's look at it, yeah.
Okay. So this is a cross-platform client that runs on Mac, Windows, Linux. And we're going to go through the same exercise we went through with the API, but we're going to do it with the GUI.
Cool.
So here, I'm actually going to choose the file type I want. But you can see here, I've got a choice between CSV, text, JSON. We don't make you choose those as explicit types here. I have a choice of picking files locally, blob, data
That's
lake.
Cool.
And I have the choice of choosing a file or a directory. So in this case.
Oh, because the directory might have like 100 of the same file type, for example.
You, sir, are a genius. You have earned your pay for the day today.
Yes.
Let's go ahead and take that deep data file that we were looking at earlier. And you'll notice this is detecting up in the top right-hand corner. That's us learning a program about how to read the data, just like you saw that little pause in the API when I was using it earlier. So we're just using the same approach as the API. And so you can see, we've detected it's a delimited file. It has custom. It's going to skip the first three lines. So all the same stuff that you saw before. Here's what it could have detected this as. Wasn't fixed width, wasn't plain text, wasn't JSON. So we did that auto-detection stuff you saw. We get a quick preview of the data. It's the same file as before, believe me. You get to override the data type guesses that we make. Here you can see it's mostly correct. Strings, numbers is what we're seeing.
And that's cool that you actually give some examples to verify. Because one of the things is, like, if this stuff is done magically, that's great. But when I'm looking at it, I'm like, okay. It got it right. It's like a little bit more common. Like, for example, the date one might be wrong, but it's only because the format's kind of off. But it did a pretty good job.
Yeah. It's generally pretty good. And if there's enough bad stuff in there, then it's going to default to something like string and then let you clean it up later. Because
sure.
you don't want stuff being auto-fixed. You kind of want to know what was going on with it in the way through. And we add this one extra column here called path. And that helps you if you're recursing over directories. Because sometimes the path to the file and the file name are actually part of the data you ultimately want. So if you're doing IoT, the device ID is probably either in the file
right.
name or in the path, the day, the month, the year, the time.
Oh, I get
and
it.
And so you want to be able to put that in as a column, and then you can use our extraction technology to say, well, pull the month out, pull the day out, rather than having to write some regex thing to parse where it came from. We just capture the fully qualified path to the file. Whatever information is in there, you can then use normal data prep techniques to get that data out again.
And
turn it into column.
This makes sense when you're actually loading up a folder of files because that file name is part of the data.
Exactly.
Got
yep.
it. Okay.
Well, it's not, I mean, it can be nested n levels deep in some of these cases. Now, here's one of the big things. Although we can load much more data than you would normally be able to do on a desktop, far bigger than memory, there's even when you're doing that, there's a performance responsiveness. And if you're doing this very iterative, interactive way of working with data, which people have in the data science world have gotten so used to with REPL environments, mm-hmm. and that's really one of the big changes from doing ETL or ELT, where you're not really interactive, then you know, even if I've got a million rows, you know, I might downsample it down to 50,000 so I can just move fast.
Right.
Right. So here we allow you to create a sample. We'll default to top 10,000. And the trick we do here is, by default, we'll give you the top. Because we can just stream that straight off the file and you can get going super fast. If you want a random sample, we actually have to make a pass over all of the data
right.
to generate a truly random sample. So what we'll do here is we allow you to create other samples. And here we'll say I can have top, I can have random n, random percentage, we're working on stratified sampling. Take a different approach, we'll kick it off asynchronously. So you still get moving really quickly in the tool by doing the top n, but then we'll create your other samples for you. And you can kick
cool.
off like 10 or 12 samples here if you want to with different rules against them. That works both locally and remotely. In the remote case, if I was reading this from blob storage, we'd kick off a bunch of Scala code on a Spark cluster that you'd have to tell us which Spark cluster you wanted to use, kick off those asynchronous jobs, it would go ahead and generate everything, we pull it down, we cache it, then you can just make use of it in the UI, and I'll show you how to change samples in a second.
That's cool, because like generally, like I always do top stuff, top N, right? But I'm always worried that is this sample indicative of the distribution or the process that generates these types of data. And I worry that like if I'm only looking at the first 100 or 2,000, I'm going to have a problem. But this lets me look at all sorts of different combinations of
yeah.
data.
And we're actually working on some tech for the tool and for the API. It's not available right now, which will allow you to diff your samples from a statistical perspective and allow you to take a look at one or two samples and say, okay, you know, this is the full data set, because in reality, the most important sample is full.
Yeah.
Because you're going to want to compare every one of your samples against the full data set in the cloud in a big data set case. And you always compare yourself against those. You always compare the different samples. And you may want your samples to use different distributions for a very specific reason.
Right.
You may want them to follow along. The choice is yours. So we'll provide some visual diffing tools. We're working with some folks in MSR, and some folks in our team are working on some of this as well. So you'll be able to visually take a look at your samples and then look at the statistics about them and determine if you have the right samples you're working on.
And this is super useful because, like, usually I'm running these machine learning models and each epoch takes like 12 hours. But if I can pull a sample that is indicative of the overall overall distribution, I could actually run experiments on something that statistically is similar to the overall thing.
Yeah,
which is really cool.
The workflow here would be generate one or n samples, evolve really quickly during the day on those smaller samples, tune which family of algorithms are you going to use and which featurizers you're going to use. Some of the stuff that we showed on the Titanic data set a couple of episodes ago, you go decide which approach you're taking, what's
right.
your hypothesis, play around with a bunch of that. What's the range that I want to pass for the regularization rate to logistic regression?
Sure.
Something like that. And then run on the full data set overnight. But you're now much more informed. Your hypothesis is much more likely to be correct when you go spin that 2,000 node cluster, which is going to cost you a couple of dollars to be able to go
couple
ahead and
of
do it.
Dollars. Love it.
OK, so we're going to do sampling. We'll take the easy example just for this. I'm going to say include the path column, but we don't need it because it's a single file. And it's going to go ahead and drop us in. We get a sheet-centric view. But I can also flip here, and I can take a look at the metrics, what we call the metrics view. So here you can immediately see for every single column, which has now been turned into a row, I get all those statistics that you saw from the API.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see NANs and quartiles. I can see a default visualization for everything. So for all the string columns, we get frequency tables. For the number columns, we get histograms. So the idea here is develop an understanding, help you develop your hypothesis
sure.
about the data using visualization and statistics, which is something that I've talked about a couple of times before. And you can choose which metrics you want. And we're constantly adding more metrics as customers ask for them. And it's something that's fairly easy for us to do. So we'll go ahead and we'll flip back. So we'll flip back to the data here. So here we've got no real transformations of the data. We just got the basic load. These are the building blocks of the load. Let's go ahead and show off that derived column by example that I showed at the API level. Let's show a much more complex one. Take a look at this founded column here. This is an actual table from Wikipedia. And it uses pretty much every single date format you could think of and that you probably couldn't think of all in the same table.
It's giving me heartburn.
Yeah, OK. So let's solve your heartburn a little bit. So here we're just going to go derived column by example. I'm going to give an example. We're going to do exactly the same thing that we did from the API perspective, except here I'm going to do February 21 of 1973.
But now, it's filling stuff out for you.
So we're already able to understand the data because we're looking at the data, we're looking for the formats, we're looking for what you might be headed towards as a canonical format, and so we can provide data IntelliSense for you here. So let's go ahead and we'll select that as our format. So it's going to go off, remember, generate a whole bunch of programs in memory, pick the best ones, through scoring, and then apply it to the data set. Now this time, unlike being able to determine that you're a mister, we weren't able to get them all correctly. The data quality bar says, you got 26 correct, but you've got 40 nulls in here. We generate a null if we can't generate a meaningful
right.
program in this particular case. So let me just ignore that. I thought I'd switch that off. You gotta love technology. So what do we do now? Well, what we do is we give more examples. This is just like giving more data to an algorithm or tuning an algorithm if you're doing inside the iSpace. But we can be smarter than that, so we'll go into advanced mode here. And what we're able to do is show suggested examples. And what these are examples which represent a cluster or a class of problem that we weren't able to generate a program for.
Oh.
We're basically saying, if you give me an example for this case, I will be able to fix n other cases inside of the data set.
That's cool.
So we're using AI to make the AI smarter, to make your data clean for AI.
That's a lot of AI going everywhere. I love it.
I think I need a t-shirt with Inception on it than with Clippy on it. So let's go ahead and give another example here. And you can see if you look at this format that the initial format example I gave and this one is two input variables. Mm. They're far enough apart that the algorithm may not be able to get the right answer. So let's go ahead, we'll select this one and we'll promote it to be an excellent example. So now we're going to go regenerate our program, pick a winner again, and if you look at the data quality bar, we're now down to only 13 cases where we're generating a null. So we're getting better. So I'm going to provide an example for this one here, which is January. And this one, it doesn't actually able to do IntelliSense because it's like, why is there a letter A at the end? I'm so confused. And we'll do that one. And then now we're down to only 11 in this particular case. Huh. So we've gone from 40 plus incorrect examples down to only 11. The thing that's interesting about those 11, if you look at the suggested example, is they're all cases where there's a single digit year in this particular case.
Right.
And so from that perspective, oh, what do I want to do with that data now? I can do something like 1st of January and put a sentinel value in. But if my data is the least bit time series sensitive in any way, shape, or form,
it could be a problem.
Now I'm actually going to be forcing a distribution on my data that's not actually something that I want to go ahead and do. So in this particular case, what I'm actually going to do is turn around and say, you know what? I'm actually going to take those nulls because just coalescing to null was a feature by itself. Because otherwise, if I had to do either the look for a year only, you know, write some expression that looked for a year, or do the old VB trick, which is trim string, the date represented as a string, count the number of characters, and if there's only four in there, then it's a single year type approach to it, right? Still works, but it's not exactly the most scientific. So in this case, we'll take the null. And I'm just going to pop up here a couple of visualizations to show, oops, it's not what I meant to do at all. Let's pop up a couple of visualizations here to help us understand what's going on with our data. So here I'm going to bring up a histogram of this column, and we'll bring up a histogram of this particular column over here. Okay, so these are the two numeric columns in this data set. So now what I'm going to do is I want to get rid of those nulls because that's going to freak out some algorithms. So we'll simply do a filter. I could do a replace. I'm going to do filter in this case to values which are not null. So now if you take a look at the histograms have two colors on them. They have a blue and a gray. The blue is the current value. The gray is the previous value before the current state change. We call this the halo effect. What you now get is immediate feedback that the change you made did make changes to the distribution. And you can see from this data set, I'm not too worried about the change to my data. I think my hypothesis to eliminate the nulls is actually a good one in this particular case because the data is still roughly the same shape as it was before. I'm not horribly offended by it in this particular case.
And that's actually really cool because sometimes when you're making these kinds of changes, you don't really have a sense for what did it do. When I'm looking at these distributions, I can see that the histogram heights have changed, but they've changed equally across the entire distribution.
Yeah.
So that those particular samples that I removed are not going to affect the distribution of the phenomena that we're trying to measure.
That's exactly it.
That's pretty cool.
And so this is all about the thing I said at the very beginning of the first of these three shows that we've done, which is data prep is an iterative, interactive, hypothesis-driven way to solve problems. I'm going to come up with a hypothesis. Hey, I should eliminate these nulls.
Yeah.
Like any scientific method, I have to evaluate my hypothesis. You just evaluated my hypothesis and gave me the thumbs up that it was okay. So I'm going to move on and do something else now with my data. But you could have turned around and said, don't like your hypothesis, Ewan. You know, go back, do not pass go, and do not get your $200. And I would simply go over here and eliminate that filter column. I can edit it. I can go back and change it if I want to.
That's cool.
And so this is just the way data works. And we could do, you know, you've seen the length of the list of transforms which exist in the menu. I'm not going to go through all those. But we can just do that. And you apply, you know, you attack a certain number of columns at a time or one column at a time, get that into a state where you need it. Apply some of the featureizers that we saw from the API or even that we saw when I was doing the pure code-centric approach at the beginning. All those are available here. And you just keep running through these and evolving things as you go forwards over time. But that essentially is the way that the GUI works. It's all the same capability that we have in the API. But now I can take this, if I want to, I can serialize it out to that deep prep format that we saw in the last one, and I can go load it up on a Spark cluster just using that load deep prep that we saw in the API session, and it will generate the code. Remember the architecture. Mm-hmm. When I'm running here, I'm running on C# Core CLR. When I'm running up in Spark, I'm going to generate Scala code, and it'll scale. And if this is a particular set of transformations which will scale out, it'll scale those out. And we're very careful about how we actually build some of our transformations. For a long time, for example, we didn't have a median in our aggregator.
Really?
Because Well, median is always estimated in a distributed cluster like a Spark cluster. And we didn't want to catch people by surprise, but we've actually talked to a bunch of customers, like, if you call it estimated median, actually in the dropdown, we'd be okay with using it. But if you said you were able to do a median and claimed you could do a distributed median, we would call you on it because Spark doesn't support an actual 100% correct distributed median in this particular case.
Well, how
it's could always
you,
estimated, right? Yeah. Right? And so we've been very careful to really optimize the way that we do things so that they only really work when we can scale them up and out.
Fantastic.
Let me show one other thing here before we call up. So this is some technology from Microsoft Research. This is, in this particular case, a list of cities. So we'll go ahead and we'll take a look at a value count here, which is a frequency table. And I know that there are actually more cases here, but you'll see at the minimum, we have San Francisco listed twice with different cases in it. Let's go ahead and bump this to 20 examples in here. And by the way, any of these visualizations, if you want to see them in more detail, you can just simply bring them up into the main view like this. In this case, 20 in that little thumbnail is not very useful. But you can see here that we've got San Diego a couple of times, San Jose a couple of times, San Francisco a couple of times. So this is a pretty common problem that we see inside of data. So it's slightly inconsistent. You know, the strings are not right. You use uppercase because you like to shout at people a lot.
That's right. You want to shout
I'm British, so I'm much more polite than
of
that.
Course,
I use
course.
The correct capitalization. And so let's take that city column, and we'll go ahead and we'll apply a fuzzy grouping to it. And so a fuzzy grouping in this particular case is using a clustering technique. And what it's doing is it's trying to cluster the values. And so here we set it off on the data set using statistics again of the data. And you'll see it found four clusters. In this particular case, it said, okay, there's four clusters, one for each of the cities, and here's how I'm going to map all the values into that. Now I can take any one of these clusters and I can remove it and then force it to recompute the clusters. I can change what the centroid in the cluster is by just renaming the string here. I can take any one of these individual entries and remove it and from the cluster. We'll add the ability to manually move nodes between clusters at some point. I can also change the similarity threshold here. And if I bump this down to 0.6, you'll see that the number of clusters disappears. And so it drops from a 4 to a 2 because we're changing how accurate the measurement has to be in terms of the similarity. We found that somewhere in the 0.7, 0.8 region is a good place to start. And we'll say in this particular case, we'll do a 0.8. So we'll go ahead and we'll simply apply that. And you'll see now we end up with a second column over here, which has got the canonical value, just what the default name
That's
is.
That's cool.
If I go ahead and apply a frequency table to this one, you'll see that we've brought it down to just the 4 from the 20 values that we had. One mouse click, supervise the action, done. And that'll work scaled out as well.
Is it running like k-means underneath or something? What is it doing?
We are way more sophisticated than that. It's a Jaccard similarity score is actually what's being calculated using a hierarchical clustering. It's actually, this technology Microsoft Research has had for a really long time.
That's really cool.
The team that built this, a guy called Surjit Chowdhury and a guy called Vivek, are two guys I've worked with from my days in the SQL Server team. I worked on SQL Server 7, 2000, 2005, 2008. And it's actually part of SQL Server Integration Services and some other tools at Microsoft. But we worked with them and they were like, hey, we're thinking about maybe pushing the boundaries of the research a little bit. So they came up with a new algorithm and they've done a distributed implementation of some of this stuff as well, which is hard to do. Right? This stuff is hard to do.
So it's using unsupervised learning to dedupe data that you're going to be using for machine learning.
Yeah. So there's a recurring theme here. We used machine learning to read the files correctly.
Right.
We used machine learning to help the machine learning to do the derived column by example because we're recommending those values which have got the clusters associated with them. And here we are again. So the goal here is really to take as much of the smart technology that we're lucky enough to have kicking around in various parts of the Microsoft world, put it into a single API, put it into a single graphical tool, and allow people to be much more efficient in terms of how they do their data prep, and allow the smart PhD guys to go focus on modeling and all that, hyperparameters and tuning,
and
all that kind of stuff, instead of messing around with dates, which is what they spend too much time doing today.
I've been messing around with dates forever in this kind of data sets. Thanks so much for your time, my friend.
My pleasure.
Thanks so much for watching. We're learning all about data preparation and this new tool. What is this tool called, by the way?
Microsoft Data Prep User Interface is just what we're calling for now. We'll come up with something cool at some point in the future.
And we'll put a link below so you can go download it and try it today. He wants to get all the good feedback, so make sure you send it over. Thanks so much for watching, and we'll see you next time. Take care.